You and I back together again on a primary day, Tuesday, August 9th, 2022 edition of Connecticut Today. I urge folks at the beginning of the show to wait, take a breath, and get the entire story on Monday night's FBI raid on the Florida home of former President Trump. New Haven Independent editor Paul Bass joined us during the show to talk about this year's primaries, as did Southern Connecticut State University political science professor Dr. Jonathan Wharton. And we were joined by former FBI agent Ken Gray to discuss that Monday night FBI raid on the Florida home of President Trump. But I wanted to start with this, and let's start with this today. Everybody needs to calm down on this Trump raid thing last night. Let's talk a little about this, and if you want to shoot in some 2 cents or so, 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Once again, 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. All right, everybody needs to calm down here. There are people online. I mean, this lunacy. Oh, my God. There are people online comparing the FBI's the Stasi now. It's the Gestapo, or as Marjorie Taylor Greene likes to say, the Gazpacho. You don't believe me? Look it up. The Gestapo, the Stasi, the secret police. For the love of sweet God, will everybody take a breath and calm down? All right. I mean, immediately last night, the stuff that was lighting up my phone and some of the stuff I'm reading on social media among, national folks and people around here in Connecticut, it's lunacy here. Lunacy. Now, are there a lot of questions as to what the FBI was doing there? Absolutely. And people deserve to have those questions answered, right? We all deserve that. As voters, most of us in the country, as taxpayers, to some level, just about all of us. So, yeah, I mean, when the FBI gets someone to sign off on a warrant, and apparently it was some judge in Florida, his name is floating about now, to sign off on something, this high profile, that you're going to do a raid with guns showing, which, by the way, is pretty much standard procedure here for the FBI, and former FBI agent Ken Gray is coming on the show a little bit later to go over that for us again. And I have a friend of mine that works for the FBI. I actually have a couple of friends, and this was pretty much standard procedure here. Does it look great? No. No, I get it. I understand it. Should they have been there? Well, you can debate that. Why was the raid called? We'll talk about that, all the theories coming out right now. But please, for the love of God, whichever God you pray to, calm down. We're going to rip the FBI. We're going to blow up the FBI. We're going to do an investigation here and then do an investigation here. Now, I'm sure, you know, everybody wants it now. Everybody needs to have, we need to know now. We need to know right now. Calm down. You and I and everyone else will find out in good time, because the FBI certainly has to justify this. Now, don't they? The Attorney General, Merrick Garland, he's going to have to justify this in some reason. He's going to be asked about this. And they know this. They're adults. Okay? The FBI generally does raids in one way. They show the maximum amount of force. An old radio buddy of mine, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, he was doing some other stuff, loved doing media, but one day he said, hey, I think I may apply for the FBI. So he went ahead and did a long story short. He got in. He's an investigator. Forensic investigator. He had to go down to the FBI Academy in Quantico, Virginia. But he told me, and we were laughing about it. I said, boy, you're going to be carrying a gun. He goes, I don't know, you think? I said, oh, yeah. And sure enough, he finds out when they finally shook his hand and said, welcome to the Bureau. Here's the paperwork for your sidearm. And, yeah, whenever there's a raid, it may look bad. It may not look comfortable, but whenever there's a raid, the people there, most of them, are armed. They have guns. Now, the operative thing is, if they have a gun, you probably shouldn't shoot at them. Thank God that didn't happen yesterday. But the stuff I'm reading here, let's wait till they justify, or at least try and justify, what they did. Now, apparently, after we've had a few hours to soak this all in, apparently now there are more and more details coming out this afternoon that this has to do with, yes, those 13 or 15 or so boxes of classified documents that apparently the feds say, I guess the National Archives, the FBI, whatever, says, hey, Mr. Trump should not have removed those from the White House. Now, what's on those documents? Who knows? Is it highly classified stuff to do with, I don't know, international relations, nuclear weapons? Maybe there's some greasy stuff about members of Congress. I don't know. Could very well be. You never know. And I guess they've been in discussions with Trump's lawyers over the past few months about returning those boxes. And I guess they've tried and tried. They were even able to cajole the president or his staff to keep them in a locked room at Mar-a-Lago, which was still a little greasy. They didn't like that because, you know, I guess this stuff is high profile stuff. Maybe some of it's embarrassing. You know, I don't know. And you just don't know. Now, they're going to have to justify this. And my guess is they're going to hold a news conference sooner than later and say, OK, here are the facts. We met with his attorney on this date. We met with his attorney on that date. We were given assurances that we would get these back. And I guess they said, screw it, we're going in. Now, why did they do that now? That can be kind of a different question. You don't know. Are the feds worried that they won't be able to get anything definitively criminal regarding January 6th? Maybe. Maybe there's a thinking that, hey, if we can get him on these charges of mishandling sensitive documents or secret documents, that would, you know, maybe disqualify him from running again in 2024. Although I'm reading, you know, opinions of legal scholars this morning on both sides of the aisle who say, well, no, not necessarily, because it didn't disqualify Hillary from, you know, when she nuked those emails on a private server. So there's a lot to unpack here. We'll go to the phones momentarily. 333-9422, 333-WICC. Just understand that we don't know the whole story yet. We just don't. We'll get there. It'll come out in a few days. We'll get to the real story. Why was this done? We already know the name of the judge or the magistrate who signed off on this. Was there an initial okay from Merrick Garland, right? Christopher Wray at the FBI, was Trump hired him. Did he sign off on it? Again, a whole bunch of stuff here we just don't know. So everyone, please take a breath. Traffic and weather together, and then your calls coming up on WICC. And I'm not saying you can't be concerned over this FBI raid, because you're sitting there and all this news is, you know, blowing up on your computer last night and on your phone, and folks are on discussion groups. And you know what happened, I guess, right around the time that Mr. Trump got on a conference call to endorse Leora Levy in the Santa campaign. And of course, we'll be getting to that momentarily. But it's the kind of thing, and I knew this was going to happen. I had a feeling. I knew this was going to happen, that everybody's going to start talking about this like it's the end of the world. It's not. Is it serious? You bet it is. Are the visuals great? No, they're not. Is there some ulterior motive around here? Yeah, I guess there is. It's not every day you see an FBI raid with guns drawn on the home of a former chief executive who is contemplating another run. No. You don't see or hear that every day. I get that. But some of the stuff I'm reading from people, calm down. Because when you jump to conclusions, it just makes you look bad. Now, you may be right in the end. And if you're right in the end, then take a breath and say, I told you so. But, you know, you've got to stop, this attitude that anytime any slings and arrows are foisted at Donald Trump, it's like the Pope, Jesus Christ, Frank Sinatra, and Mother Teresa are all being attacked at the same time. A lot of this stuff he brings on himself. A lot he doesn't, because there are people hating on the guy the minute he won the election, and they were vowing to bring him down. I get that. I understand that. But so far, the FBI and the DOJ are not commenting on why they went there. They're going to have to say something eventually, right? If they don't say anything, and this goes on for weeks and months, then it just fuels the pro-Trump forces in the country, fuels Republicans. I mean, they got to know this. And again, my initial thought when I saw this happening and I said, okay, this is probably has to do with these 15 boxes of classified documents, you know, whatever. My initial thought was, well, okay, you know, they're trying to get him on mishandling or the improper handling of classified documents, which is against some part of the federal U.S. code. And then maybe in the end they can say, aha, see, and this disqualifies him from running for the White House again. Because listen, whether you like the guy or not, here's the bottom line. There are a lot of people in both parties and in the management levels of government, you may agree with them, you may not, there are a lot of people just terrified that he may run again. A lot of people in the Republican Party who said, fine, Mr. President, you give us a good 4 years, but we have to move on. We can't take your shenanigans anymore. You know, there are Democrats fearing that, too, knowing that, you know, he still has like 35 to upper 30s to maybe 40%, support among the party. Loyalists, and they may say, geez, we got to do something. We've got to, you know, there's got to be a gut punch somewhere. Something has to happen somewhere, because we got to take this guy out. But in the end, and it may take weeks, it may take months, it may come 10 minutes from now. It may come, near the end of the show. Who knows? They're going to have to justify why was it done. They're just going to have to. They can wait this out for a few days or a week. Maybe they're banking on the media backlash, not media backlash, but the media spotlight and the questions on both sides of the aisle. Okay, let's just let this calm down and maybe we can move on. I doubt that'll happen, but we shall see. And hopefully, if you are registered with one of the two major political parties in the state, you have done your due diligence and gotten up to vote either early this morning on your way to work, maybe on your lunch hour, or heading home. Some pretty fascinating primaries. Now, the turnout is likely going to be light, but maybe not. And to offer his thoughts on this, we spoke to this gentleman before, and he runs, as I mentioned, one of the best micro news sites anywhere in the entire U.S. We talk about it all the time, the New Haven Independent. Go online, check it out, newhavenindependent.org. And an interesting story here. Tuesday primaries test strength, not issues. Paul Bass is with us. Hey, Paul, how are you, sir? How you been?
Good. How you doing, my friend?
I'm trying, Paul, just like we all are, right? It's hot and we're all trying.
Another day.
Yeah, right. It's always good to just get up in the morning. Paul, and I know everybody's been tied up in the Senate primary, but boy, these other primaries for Secretary of the State, and Treasurer are really fascinating. Let's start with the Democrats' Secretary of the State battle here. And you've got Maritza Bond, very familiar to folks in New Haven and Bridgeport, who's got a huge labor backing, Paul, but she did not get the party endorsement.
Yeah, remember, Paul, six different people were running Democrats for Secretary of State. So the person who was most likely to win ended up not winning. We can go into that or not. It's old history.
Sure.
She had this, crazy convention, which probably was the first convention where that kind of unpredictable outcome occurred since this century, perhaps. And Stephanie Thomas did not expect to get the party nomination. She's a first-term legislator from Fairfield County. She's respected, and she won a Democratic seat that had been Republican. So that was her pitch. But she didn't expect to get the party endorsement. And she, when she gave a speech at that convention, she said, I didn't have a speech because I didn't think I'd get it. But then the party coalesced around her. They felt that in November, it'll be good for the Democrats to have someone who could appeal across party lines. And then Maritza Bond was the person of the six who had the least elected experience but the most energy.
Mm-hmm.
So she's kind of a ball of fire. She's the city health director in New Haven. She did the pandemic, worked a lot with people, and she's stepping out to try to be sort of a new, younger generation face in politics. And then, as you mentioned, even though labor issues have nothing to do with the Secretary of State job, labor unions are working hard for her because they're not happy with votes that Stephanie Thomas took or didn't take in the legislature on labor issues. But more broadly, what's interesting to me about these two hard-fought primaries, Paul, is that there are big issues at stake for the state about Secretary of State and the Treasurer, and they're playing out nationally. They're not playing out in this primary because all the Republicans agree with each other. The Democrats agree with each other. So what you're having today, Paul, is figuring out who each party thinks will be the best person to run and who is supported by which faction of a party that has more strength, for instance, the Trump faction of the Republican Party in the Senate race or the Labor faction in the Democratic Secretary of State race. When November comes, we're going to be talking about some really important issues about how we run elections, how we invest $45 billion of state assets in the Treasurer's office, and they tap into conservative and liberal ideas, and there are honest differences of opinion, and it's going to matter. But today is a different story. Today is just a power battle. Who gets to do it, which factions of the party rule, and who's going to be going for the prize in November.
And everybody's been talking about the U.S. Senate race, three-way race on the Republican side. But as we said just minutes ago with our guest here, Paul Bass, editor of the New Haven Independent, the other constitutional office primaries are rather interesting. Paul, let's talk about the state treasurer's race. You have Karen Dubois-Walton, very well-known person around the New Haven area, Eric Russell, and a very familiar face here in Fairfield County, Dita Bargava. You know, Bargava's ads, Paul, I found were really interesting, weaving in the issue of abortion. And she had a really good, from a production point of view, TV ad that I guess was rejected first by some outlets, and then they finally took it. This race, too, is fascinating.
It is to me, Paul, because who would remember anyone paying attention to a state treasurer race?
Exactly.
It used to be this really boring job, right? Like, go to Wall Street, find the best way to get a return on billions of dollars in pension funds and other state investments. So that's an important thing. What you're seeing happen this year in both parties is both parties have injected, and I'm not saying it's a bad thing, ideology into that job. So Republican state treasurers nationwide have formed an alliance to try to use all their power to divest from any investment funds that don't invest in coal or other fossil fuels. So they're trying to use the state treasurer job to protect fossil fuels. The Democrats, similarly, they say, well, gee, we want people to be talking about abortion. We want to talk about guns and pharmaceutical companies. Even though those issues have not traditionally been treasurer issues, all three Democrats are saying we're going to use our investments to try to accomplish goals that make Connecticut a place where people can afford to get some help. Derek Russell wants to set up a fund if you want to come here and get an abortion because you're from a red state. Or Dita Bargava got attention saying she, too, will try to use the investment money to persuade people to invest, to not support abortion restrictions. And she got attention for it because Disney's Hulu channel rejected her ad, and then they accepted it. So that's like hitting the jackpot for a candidate. You get press for being rejected for the ad. Everyone sees the ad, then it plays. Karen DuBois Walton has a long history of supporting public housing and managing bond funds that built housing development. She also is on the State Board of Education. So she, too, has talked about social justice as an aim in how we invest. What's interesting to me, Paul, is I wonder if anyone in November is going to say what they used to say, which is that she's job is who gets the best return, period.
Yeah.
Or do these races reflect that? And remember, I'm not weighing in that it's necessarily good or bad. That you should have some kind, either from the right or for the left, you need to have some kind of social responsibility attached with how you use your state money and invest it, or even just to try to advance society. So nothing's apolitical anymore in America, and that includes the state treasurer's race in Connecticut.
Yeah, and obviously, Paul, no matter who wins, probably, likely on the Democratic side, we know what the numbers are, but you wonder if, as you just said, you may have some people in the General Assembly, maybe Republicans, but even some Democrats saying, hey, are we, now that Governor Lamont is preaching all this fiscal responsibility and we're going to be smart with our investments, I don't know, Paul, if there's maybe even an appetite for that in the General Assembly. I mean, it may sound good, again, Paul, in a primary, but as you say, does the average voter say, hey, you got to be like a baseball umpire. You got to upset 50% of the people 50% of the time and call it down the middle.
Yeah, and I think the issue there is you're running these. I'm not even sure why these are elected positions. So given that's elected position, they try to get people to care about the position. And given what you said about the numbers with 900,000 something unaffiliated voters in Connecticut, 800,000 and change Democrats, only 400,000 and change Republicans, I think you're right. In the general election, it might be kind of moot. But we'll see.
And finally, Paul, how do you think the so far we have months to go, but the governor's race here, how do you think this is playing out? I noticed, and you obviously did too, the latest narrative now for Governor Lamont is saying, hey, the governor's really good for cities like New Haven, like Bridgeport, like Hartford. He cares. So I guess, Paul, the thing that doesn't change here is if the governor is going to win, he needs a good turnout from the cities.
Yeah, I think everything's about the unaffiliated voters this year, Paul, given that there's so many of them. And Lamont and Stefanowski, the Democrat and Republican candidates, ran against each other 4 years ago, and they actually have to run very different campaigns this time. Now Lamont's running as an incumbent, and I actually think his biggest emphasis is he tried to steal the Republicans' issues early on by saying under no circumstances will he raise taxes, even on the wealthy, which is what a lot of Democrats thought should be done. And he wouldn't do it because he knew you couldn't run for re-election that way. So it kind of takes the air out of some of the Republican issues. Stefanowski this time is trying to pay more attention to cities than he did last time. He's been here a bunch of times. His challenge is that the people were kind of satisfied with Lamont's handling of COVID, the majority of people. And our bond rating has gone up for the first time in a long time because we made investments in the pension fund and in the rainy day fund. Stefanowski's running hard on inflation. We'll see what the prices at the pump will be in October and November. Right now, obviously, he hasn't found an issue yet to grab onto. That doesn't mean he won't. I do think the governor's race is very different from the other state races, Paul. Even though we've had a Democratic governor for 20 years, in fact, Connecticut voters are purple in the governor's race. We had Republican and independent governors for a long time before that. Mm-hmm. And that I think people see, and this is from an old poll Toby Moffitt did when he tried to run for governor, that people see their governor as a manager or a banker, and they see their congresspeople and senators as fighters. So given that we've become a blue state on national issues, although you don't know what's going to happen in the 5th District this year, in general, Democrats win all the national seats. I think the governor's race is up for grabs, but something's going to have to break Stefanowski's way because, as you know from watching elections, Paul, there's so much you can do to run the best you can. You got to do that so you don't lose any votes through unforced errors. But a lot of it's beyond your control, what's happening in the world at that moment. So at the beginning of this race, it looked like Biden's unpopularity could drag Lamont down, Today, it's a different story. We don't know what the story is going to be in October.
Absolutely.
Going to need something to something's going to have to go Stefanowski's way.
Yeah, something's going to have to break for an oh, wow moment. Great stuff, as always. Paul Bass, he is the editor, the founder. He's the big kahuna. He is the king at the, at the New Haven Independent, newhavenindependent.org. Paul, we got to do this more often. Thank you, sir. Take care.
Thanks, Paul. Great to hear from you.
Appreciate it. On this primary day, Tuesday, the 9th of August, 2022, yes, primaries are very important. They're generally low turnout affairs, but they do yield interesting results to talk about what we may see or may not see, and what does it all mean, the grand question. One of our go-to folks, political science professor Jonathan Wharton, Southern Connecticut State University in New Haven. John, hi, it's Paul. Good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Good afternoon, Paul. Hey, happy little Commonwealth season day here. I love it.
Yes,
happy
Yeah, I mean, it's you and I love this stuff, John, and it's sad that a lot of people kind of poo-poo this. And, John, before a couple of segments ago, I was reminding people, hey, in the 2nd District several years ago, we had a general race decided by 21 votes, 90 votes in that same district. A few years later. But man, John, it really is true. The fewer votes you have, really, by statistical numbers, the more important each vote is.
Well, especially because in some of these statewide races, as you already know, for like treasurer and even secretary of state, we're seeing multiple candidates, or even the obviously the Republican ticket here for Senate. We're seeing more than just, you know, two candidates here. So, turnout's going to be critical. But as you know, historically, you're likely to get 30% because the diehards are the ones who are going to come out in the middle of summer, especially on a 90-something degree day.
You know, John, I've been saying to my listeners here, this Senate primary, this is almost from central casting, right? You have three people, which is kind of a good primary number, I think. You have one or two people saying they're doctrinaire to their party, maybe one more than the other. And then you have a third person that actually angers a lot of the Republican base. Themis Claridis, she's anti-gun, she's anti-this or that. But yet she may have the best chance in November against an entrenched incumbent. This is fascinating.
Well, not only that, we can't forget, too, this, Paul. I mean, you know, Themis Claridis, at least, has really among the candidates been the one who's been an elective office for and has done so for years. And she did gain the endorsement at the convention back in May. And that's critical because remember that little star behind your name is very important for voters out there because that party endorsement carries, you know, the name recognition and you're the first one of the party lines, you know, line up at the poll.
Yeah, and that's important. And John, you know, I was reading a couple of pundits earlier today who say, you know what? The Trump endorsement for Leora Levy, despite that little gathering at Mar-a-Lago last night, and the phone call, the endorsement, it might have helped her if it came earlier in the process. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that, you know, any way to get your name out there is critical, you know, for good or for bad, or even endorsement of Donald Trump, right? Because it gets people riled up. It gets people interested. And the thought is that people show up. And then one thing that Levy is, you know, she certainly is good at angling is that, you know, she's got some support, you know, coming from Fairfield County, especially because obviously she's coming from Greenwich. So it's no secret out there that she's been a committee woman for the National Party and has done so for years. And of course, she's been a fundraiser for the party too. And I think, you know, I was on State Central for the party a couple of years back. And so she's very well known as an entity for fundraising for the state party.
John, did anybody in the State Central Committee of the State Party, did anybody, at least in your time there, envision her as somebody who would eventually run, or was she thought of maybe as this really vital behind-the-scenes person?
She made herself kind of more as a vital behind-the-scenes person, and I also want to include that she was very supportive of some candidates, but really helping out to recruit staff, you know, especially when it came to, considering candidates for the director position, which was critical for the party, for the state party. So she's always been behind the scenes for a while, but people know her. I mean, she's a known entity, State Central.
And we continue on this primary day. Yes, round one primary day today, then about 3 months down the line, the general election in 2022. Open phones coming up at 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Professor Jonathan Wharton, one of our go-to guys on all things politics, joining us here. John, I didn't think I would see in the immediate future primary races, at least on primary day, for a couple of offices that are kind of ho-hum for people, you know, Secretary of the State here in the state and Treasurer. But before we get to Treasurer, let's talk about Secretary of the State. Of course, Denise Merrill had to resign. She says she's not done with politics, but she had to, of course, deal with an ailing husband, and our thoughts and prayers go out to her. On the Republican side, you have a state legislator there, Terry Wood, and a tech guy, Dom Rapini, who was the party-endorsed candidate. But on the Democratic side, John, this is fascinating to me. You had Stephanie Thomas, who is the party-endorsed candidate, but boy, Maritza Bond, who, as you know, is well-known in New Haven and Bridgeport, she got a lot of labor backing, doesn't she?
Yeah, and early in advance. And she's a well-known brand because, you know, she's been the public health director here in New Haven. And so, you know, don't overlook her. I think it's going to be interesting whether New Haven could pull it off of her. Although, as I said to you earlier, the endorsed party candidates generally win because of, you know, the low turnout that we had discussed earlier.
And it's interesting, if you've seen the same spots I have for Maritza Bond, you know, targeting the attack ads, targeting Stephanie Thomas. I'm maybe paraphrasing here, John, forgive me, but I think the tagline on the ad pointing to Stephanie Thomas is, she's not one of us, or something like that. And I was like, that can be interpreted a bunch of ways, especially with the labor backing.
Well, that, and we can't forget that I think some people are going after, we've already seen this, you know, on the Republican side, you know, lawmakers who've been in the General Assembly, right, that they are kind of a, you know, they want to point out that they're not part of the Hartford machinery up there in the Capitol.
The Treasurer's primary, three-way primary, John, and in particular, a lot of eyebrows raised a few weeks ago when Dita Bargava took the abortion issue and wove that into campaigning for an office that, frankly, you know, a lot of people, John, like you and I, would think is, okay, keep the books and watch our investments. I found that fascinating.
Well, she's run for office before, right? This is not her first time.
Yep.
And so she's trying to get the attention. And she wants to differentiate herself from Eric Russell, who is the endorsed candidate for treasurer, as well as Karen DuBois-Walton, who, you know, has been quite a bit of a challenge because I'm fascinated, Paul, by the New Haveners fighting this out, Eric Russell and Walt. They're, you know, it's weird because Eric Russell is, the former, deputy chair or vice chair of the state party. And then Karen DuBois Walton, you know, she's been around New Haven for years and she's the housing director, but she had the endorsement of the three mayors in New Haven, you know, the current one and the two previous one, you know, John DeStefano and Tony Harp. So, I mean, boy, this is just so interesting to me. I mean, you rarely see New Haveners fight out for a state position. But I think between the treasurer's position and the secretary of state, how often do you see an opening like this where, you know, the positions are going to be vacant now? It doesn't happen on the Democratic ticket that often.
No, it doesn't. And, John, do you think these battles for treasurer and for secretary of the state, but mostly for the treasurer, as you laid out here with three distinct well-known people, is this kind of a bellwether for, you know, how the party is going here? Is maybe the state Democratic Party, are they looking at kind of what the National Party is looking at, where you have the old guard trying to tell the more progressive wing, hey, take it easy, you'll get your shot. We have to be careful how we do this.
Well, one thing is that we have an interesting habit in Connecticut, particularly, you know, for the state party, so especially for the Democrats, not to see so much upset, right? We tend to see more of the internal fighting taking place among some candidates, especially when there is an opening like this for some of these offices. And so you're right, Paul. We're seeing these challenges. There have been concerns about that. I don't want to, by the way, forget, too, some of these General Assembly races, like in West Haven, and obviously your way in Bridgeport there, with Dennis Bradley, because, again, we're seeing this challenge of, you know, whoever's the endorsed candidate and somebody else going up against somebody who might not be endorsed from it. And I'm just mesmerized by what's going on here among the Democrats and even some of the urban areas for statewide offices or even for the General Assembly races.
Yeah, John, you mentioned the West Haven primary, Trine McGee, who I guess, John, she may be pulling a bullseye on her back when she was very critical of the expansion of abortion rights here in the state, you know, going out on a limb for a Democrat saying this is not good for the Black and Hispanic community.
It's been one of those things that's not discussed enough out there in the media. I think many you know, pundits and even reporters overlook the fact that there are a number of African Americans and Latinos who are pro-life or have serious concerns about abortion, and they might even be pro-choice. And so she's brought that out. It's unusual, but, you know, it does exist out there. It's not just a partisan issue. And so I'm sure you've heard about that speech that she gave on the floor.
Yeah.
And it's gotten a lot of attention, but now you're seeing Joe Miller stepping up now, who's 24 years old, almost the same age, and you're seeing this kind of internal generational struggle over an issue like this. And I'm just like, wow, I Paul, to me, this is like Christmas for me.
Oh, I know, me too.
I love studying these anomalies and the internal fighting within a party or district and the direction where to go in. When you throw in a generational debate, oh, forget it. I mean, this is like, wow.
Yeah, this is, John, I'm telling you, this is great stuff. I mean, in past years, you know, primaries, whatever, yawn, but these are something. Professor Jonathan Wharton, Southern Connecticut State University, as always. John, we thank you for your time. Stay close, and we'll talk down the road. Thanks.
Thank you, Paul. Take care.
Appreciate it. Dr. Jonathan Wharton, Professor of Poli-Sci and Urban Policy at Southern Connecticut State University. See, for us political geeks, these are really good primaries. And three quarters of the people are going. Coming off our rather boisterous discussion of what happened a few minutes ago, we were chatting about what happened last night at Mar-a-Lago in Florida. We welcome back one of our go-to guys on things like this. Ken Gray joins us. He's a lecturer in the Criminal Justice Department at the Henry C. Lee College of Criminal Justice and Forensics at the University of New Haven. Ken is a retired FBI special agent, 24 years of service with the Bureau prior to his service with the FBI. Ken was a naval officer in the surface warfare community, U.S. Navy, during his FBI career. Ken conducted investigations in foreign counterintelligence matters, counterterrorism, computer intrusions, infrastructure protection, and the like. Hey, Ken, it's Paul here at WICC. Good afternoon. Good to talk with you again. How are you?
I'm doing well there, Paul. I'm glad to be able to talk to you again, too.
Yeah, please, because we got a lot of people, Ken, calling here, and I'm having to calm them down, Ken. I'm having to walk them all off of the ledge. But were you a little, maybe you weren't, were you a little surprised at what you saw unfolding last night?
I was indeed. I was stuck to the television watching as much as I could to try to figure out what exactly was going on.
So, Ken, first of all, people are saying the visuals and everything, and I know I have you here, and I have a friend of mine who's an investigative agent now with the Bureau, who goes on raids like this. And Ken, is it true that when raids like this are held, it may not look good, but generally a lot of people are armed? Is that true?
Oh, absolutely. FBI agents are armed. And when you go into a place, you don't know what you're going to encounter. You don't know what the people who are inside the residence think is going on. And so President Trump has security personnel. He also has Secret Service agents there at Mar-a-Lago, and so for protection. And so, you have the possibility of blue on blue. But nonetheless, agents, when they go to conduct their business, they go armed.
And, Ken, that's what I was wondering. So, obviously, Ken, those Secret Service agents and the whatever security is there at Mar-a-Lago, they obviously were given some heads up on this, right? They didn't just say, oh, here come a bunch of people in bulletproof vests and guns. Come on in. That didn't happen, did it?
You would not think that that would occur that way. You would think that there would be some heads up. But nonetheless, you don't normally give any type of advance notice when you are conducting a search warrant. When you are out doing the operation itself, you don't reach out to the person ahead of time and say, we're going to be at your door, tomorrow. Instead, you might say, while you're en route, we're going to be there in 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
That way, the evidence is not destroyed in the process.
Retired FBI Special Agent Ken Gray, one of our go-to guys when things like this happen, this being that raid on Mar-a-Lago last night, currently an instructor and criminal justice lecturer at the University of New Haven. So, Ken, take us through the process here. Obviously, somebody decided this had to be done because of the documents. The FBI's not saying whatever. Somebody gets the idea. They draft the warrant here, and then it's got to be signed off on, right, Ken, before anything can happen? And I guess some Florida magistrate judge did this. But then what happens after somebody signs off on this?
So to be able to conduct a search warrant like this, you have to go before a magistrate or a judge and present your statement of probable cause, an affidavit saying why you believe that a crime has been committed and that there is evidence of that crime located at a particular place at a particular time. And so you are going to put together this information, but the decision to go and seek a search warrant, that is something that had to be done at a very high level. One does not normally go to a grand jury and seek to get a search warrant as part of the investigation, a decision made by just an assistant U.S. attorney. This is something that has been decided upon at an extremely high level, both with the FBI. So you're talking about either the director of the FBI, Director Ray, or you're talking about somebody at the next level down making that decision with the FBI. And over at Department of Justice, you're talking about some high-level person at Maine Justice, maybe even the Attorney General himself that made this decision. And this is because of the fact that this is so unusual a situation. One does not normally conduct a search of the residence of a previous president of the United States.
No.
And so this is a decision that had to be made at the highest level to be able to grant such a decision to seek such a search warrant. And so that's the beginning of this, is the fact that they've made this decision. But it's something I'd like to point out is that
sure.
There are two different violations that are in question here. So the president of the United States, when they are finished in office, their records are part of the public record. Okay. And so when this material was taken from the White House and shipped to Mar-a-Lago, those records are actually part of the public record, and they have to be retained.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to be retained and become part of the National Archives. And so there was questions about the retention of those records and about getting them over to the National Archives. In the course of reviewing those records, the people from the National Archives found that there may have been some classified material within those records. And so you have two possible charges that could have been part of that affidavit for the search warrant. One would be the violation of the Presidential Records Act,
mm-hmm.
Which is something that has not been something subject to criminal prosecutions, but it could be. The other one is the retention of classified documents. Again, this is not something that is normally prosecuted unless there is some grievous violation of it. And so the decision is based upon, these two potential violations. Here's the key, though, is that in the event that you are prosecuted and convicted under the Presidential Records Act, one of the penalties is being barred from future office.
Mm-hmm.
And so President Trump, if he were convicted under that, he would be barred from running for office again.
Yeah, and that seems, Ken Gray, to be the thing that a lot of people are talking about. And, Ken, one thing I tried to convey to my listeners here early on, I want to ask you about this. You know, I'm reading things last night and hearing just stuff from even elected leaders and bloggers and stuff just saying the most vile things about, the FBI and people who are in your agency. And Ken, I can imagine that, maybe those agents who went on that raid have probably looked at themselves going, we're going to Trump's place to find stuff? But there is a chain of command, Ken. This is like the military in a way, isn't it? I mean, you correct me if I'm wrong, but you have to carry out your orders no matter what it looks like. I mean, we can question the higher-ups, right? But the rank-and-file people that I know in the Bureau said, yeah, an order's an order.
Absolutely. I mean, the FBI, I'm very proud of my time with the FBI. I think that the FBI is a very, very proud and very good organization. And if the FBI is investigating what they believe to be a violation, a criminal violation, they are going to go through those steps of conducting that investigation, and they're going to do it no matter who the subject of that investigation is. That being said, the FBI may be in the process of doing this investigation. They may be being dragged into politics, and that would be something that I would be very distressed about, that the FBI would be dragged into a political situation here while trying to do the right thing.
And Ken, finally, you know, a lot of the comments so far from the Bureau has been no comment, and that's not unusual, I'm sure. You know, they're being deluged now by every organization. Ken, in your opinion, and I understand it would only be your opinion, can the Bureau just stay tight-lipped? And if they can, how long can they, maybe under the guise of, well, the investigation is still going, or is there going to be enough pressure, Ken, eventually for them to get into the detail as to how and why they did this?
So normally when you see an investigative step like this, like when a search warrant is conducted, you don't see a press release from that conduction of that investigative step. You don't see the affidavit until an arrest is made. Or if an arrest is not made, you never see that information. However, in this particular case, since it is such an unprecedented situation of the search of a former president's residence, I think that DOJ or the FBI or both will have to come forward with some type of statement to the public. And I think that that will be required just simply because of the political nature of this. So normally you would not see any type of statement until an arrest was made, and then you would get to see, as part of the public record, the affidavit that was used to obtain that search warrant. But I don't think we'll see that until either an arrest is made or until politics require a statement.
Yeah, and Ken, finally, I've been doing a ton of reading on this, as I'm sure you have. There are some people suggesting that the president, the former president, and or his lawyers, if they feel wronged, they could just release a copy of the warrant. Now, do they get a copy of that warrant, Ken Gray? And could he go ahead and do that and use that as a, you know, as some sort of political tool, saying this is a witch hunt? Or is that against the law, releasing details of the investigation?
No, the president is certainly within his capability of releasing the search warrant, but the search warrant is not going to give you the affidavit. When you serve a search warrant, they get the cover page of that, the order there, the judicial order saying that to go out and conduct a search, and they get a copy of the inventory of everything that was taken. But they do not, the subject of the search does not get a copy of the affidavit. The affidavit is retained until it becomes part of the ongoing prosecution. At that point, they would get the affidavit. And at that point, we would see it as part of the public record. But I believe that the president may have already given out a copy of the search warrant, because all it will show is who conducted the search, what magistrate signed off on it, who the agent was that requested it, where it was conducted at, and when it was to be conducted, what date it was to be conducted. Other than that, there's not going to be anything going there.